Good morning. The first case of the morning is Mary Kasna v. City of Love Park. Mr. McGrail.
Thank you, Your Honors. Counsel, Dan McGrail for the plaintiff and appellant. This case involves two separate and distinct claims regarding the termination of the plaintiff, Mary Kasna. One claim involves a claim of retaliation with regard to the Americans with Disabilities Act. The second claim is a due process claim related to her denial of her rights pursuant to the Civil Service Act. I'll begin with the Americans with Disabilities Act retaliatory claim. In order to prove the direct method, the plaintiff needs to establish that there was protected activity and that there was a causal link between the protected activity and the termination. This protected activity emanates from a meeting that was called by the plaintiff where she was wanted to discuss with her supervisor an event that happened the day before. Ms. Kasna talked to her supervisor, Ms. Elliott, and told her that a misunderstanding that occurred the day earlier may have had to do with her hearing disorder, explained to her how her disorder works in terms of sometimes she needs to be spoken directly to and doesn't hear certain frequencies. During the course of this meeting, the supervisor, Ms. Elliott, made some disparaging comments regarding plaintiff's hearing. The most egregious one, which was made to the plaintiff, was, how can you do your job if you can't hear? In direct response to this and other comments that were made, the plaintiff said to Ms. Elliott, aren't you being discriminatory? At that point in time, Ms. Elliott abruptly ended the meeting, would not discuss anything further with Ms. Kasna regarding her hearing disorder or regarding any of these comments, and went directly down to her supervisor, the chief of police's office. That exchange right there constitutes protected activity. I know this court recently, in a cold case, talked about how general complaints of discrimination do not constitute protected activity. But here's a situation where the meeting was called to discuss her hearing disability. During the course of that meeting, there was a discourse regarding her hearing disability and how it affected her job. In response to that, Ms. Kasna says specifically, aren't you being discriminatory? Uses the words discriminatory in the context of this ADA discussion, and immediately after that, the meeting is halted, and the supervisor admits that she took the comment to be an accusation of discrimination.
Where was this meeting?
The meeting was in the office where they worked, in the police clerk's office.
Just by her desk, or was there a separate meeting where she was called aside, or what?
It was a separate meeting, but it wasn't a previously scheduled meeting. It was just a meeting in the workplace in the boss's office, and they were just discussing this thing. It wasn't anything that was set or established.
What was the problem that they were discussing?
They were discussing the fact that the day before, at 4:45, end of the day is 5 o'clock, at 4:45, the supervisor came and placed some police reports on the plaintiff's desk, walked away, came back just a few minutes later, just before 5, and said, haven't you filed those yet? The plaintiff said, I didn't hear you ask me to file them. And these police reports, by the way, are something that are just normally filed in the course of business. It wasn't anything that was urgent. It wasn't a routine that they had to be filed urgently. My client was concerned because her supervisor thought that she had given her an order and thought that she had heard it and disregarded it. So she called the meeting to clarify that and explain to her, because she had only been working for this supervisor for 2 months. She had been there 7 years, but only under this supervisor for 2 months. Wanted to explain to the supervisor how her hearing disorder works with regard to frequencies, with regard to people needing to face her when speaking to her. And just wanted to clarify that and wanted to sort of clean the slate and let her understand what was going on. It was in the course of that meeting that the discriminatory allegation occurred. Then the chain of events that follows the protected activity is as close to a smoking gun as you can get, if not a smoking gun. The record is clear that Elliot goes down to the chief of police's office, tells him that she's been accused of discrimination, The chief says, well, it's time to evaluate her. This is 2 months into this particular transfer. There was no plan to evaluate Ms. Kasdan at this point in time. The norm of it
be a six-month evaluation?
Generally a year. On this particular transfer, they had talked about 6 months. So this was out of the blue in response to this discriminatory remark.
Do you think it makes any difference that she presented her complaint as a question? In other words, aren't you being discriminatory as opposed to a proclamation? You are being discriminatory. Do you think that makes a difference? That does it make it seem as if she wasn't certain that the comments that elicited her response could be viewed as discriminatory?
No, Your Honor. I don't think it makes any difference at all in this context. And the reason being, because within the context of these comments, this comes right on the heel of something that really put Ms. Kasdan back on her heels. How can you do your job if you can't hear? And then she says, aren't you being discriminatory? Within that context, I don't think it matters if whether it's within a rhetorical question or not. And I think the proof is in the pudding. This isn't a case where we have to overanalyze whether it's in a question or whether it's declaratory. The proof is in the pudding in terms of how Ms. Elliott received it. When the employer receives the comment, admittedly, as being an accusation of discrimination, that has to be considered a protected activity. And in fact, that's the admission in the record. She took it as an accusation of discrimination, went down and told her supervisors it was an accusation of discrimination. And 4 business days later, she's terminated. She's not only evaluated out of sequence, but the normal protocol of allowing the employee to review the evaluation, provide their input, and sign it wasn't followed. In addition to the evaluation on the heels of this complaint, Ms. Elliott types up a memo that day regarding the incident, puts it in her personnel file, and also types up another memo, which is very defensive in its nature, with regard to any exchanges she's had with Kasdan regarding her hearing. So the chain of events is actually remarkable. The 4 business later, she'd be terminated. This is a 7-year employee who's never had a negative evaluation until this one.
Was this hearing impairment something new?
No, the hearing impairment is something that she had throughout the course of her duties there. We're not claiming that there was any prior discrimination. The initial complaint was filed with the Illinois Department of Human Rights and the EEOC, talked about discrimination. We abandoned that claim after discovery and found that this was truly a retaliatory claim and not a discriminatory claim. Then the other separate and distinct cause of action has to do with the due process violation that resulted from the city of Loves Park through resolution attempting to make Kasdan a non-civil service employee when the statute clearly made her a civil service employee. The civil service statute that exempts employees from the civil service is essentially in 2 parts. The first part talks about a certain group of high-level municipal employees that are exempt. The second part of the statute talks about a subset of those high-level municipal employees that are entitled to have an exempt secretary and administrative assistant. The legislature, now, Kasdan worked for 2 department heads in the city of Loves Park, and the statute in the first section clearly exempts heads of principal departments. In the second section, when it talks about which of the municipal officials can have a exempt secretary and administrative assistant, it specifically, the legislature specifically withdraws the heads of principal departments. And the statutory construction rules will say the legislature meant something by that deletion in the second paragraph.
Is there any distinction in employment, pay, et cetera, when you're either exempt or under civil service, other than the notice and I guess, a right to be heard and all that when you're terminated?
No, there's no evidence in the record that her pay would have been any different had she been civil service or non-civil service.
Or duties or anything. There's the only distinction is who your boss is, I guess, huh? If your boss is elected,
The distinction, correct. The distinction here would be that she would be allowed some due process before she was terminated. She'd be allowed a pre-termination hearing with the Civil Service Commission.
But the difference in her first job is, I guess she was the same job with the elected clerk, I believe.
Correct. In her first job, when she was deputy to the elected clerk,
was exempt.
Clearly exempt. Because it talks about elected officials get to have a secretary and administrative assistant, clearly exempt. But department heads, under the statute, do not have exempt secretaries and administrative assistants.
When she went over to the sheriff, was that an exempt position, or was that civil service or probationary, or was that different than where she was before?
When she went over to the police department, everybody acknowledges that would clearly be a civil service position. The respondent's position is that she was on probation over there, so civil service wouldn't have applied. The real issue becomes, was she entitled to civil service protection in the secretary office assistant position? Because if she was, the Civil Service Act does not allow for that transfer.
Well, she didn't go through the civil service process to move into that position, though. As I understand the record, it's undisputed that she never went through the civil service process.
Correct, Your Honor.
She was hired by the city into an exempt position and transferred twice after that without going through the process to become a civil service protected employee.
Correct, and that is a central issue in the case. And the district court applied the Zlanka case and said that she should not be afforded the protection of the Civil Service Act if she didn't go through the civil service application and take the civil service test. The problem with the district court's analysis, first of all, it wasn't raised by defense. This is something unilaterally raised by the court, so it wasn't involved in the 56 statements. But secondly, it's a misapprehension of the Zlanka case. The Zlanka case very specifically held that Zlanka did not hold the type of high or held the type of high level position that was exempt. Zlanka was a director of planning, research, and compliance for the Treasurer's Office. The court in Zlanka focused on the position and whether the position fit the civil service statute, and in dicta talked about, and she didn't go through the testing and the process to become civil service. The problem with applying Zlanka to this case is it sets horrible precedent in terms of what a municipality can do with regard to people that are civil service under the statute through resolution. In this case, if this case is upheld, it stands for the proposition that a municipality can, through resolution, pass a resolution or an ordinance that flies in the teeth of state statute, which is impermissible under all the case law cited in the briefs, and then, as long as the unsuspecting layperson employee doesn't realize that they truly should have been included in the civil service statute, there will be no remedy. Because if you then apply Zlanka down the road, which we say can't be applied because of estoppel principles, then they never have their day in court. Because by the very nature of the improper resolution, which designated them erroneously as non-civil service, by that very ultra-virus act, they're not going to be on the roster and they're not going to take the test. And therefore, a municipality then can vitiate the civil service statute with no remedy for the plaintiff.
How do we know she would have passed the test?
Well, she would have passed the test because she worked for 7 years for the city of Loves Park. She never had a problem. There's no negative evaluation whatsoever of her.
Well, what's on the test?
There's actually nothing in the record in terms of what that particular civil service test would have encompassed.
So we don't know whether she would have passed the test and acquired civil service status had she been given that opportunity.
Right.
She might have been kept in her non-civil service job if she had failed the test.
And then she would still be employed.
Well, that's all speculative, right? But, you know, the fact remains that she wasn't tracked into the civil service track when these transfers were made. But she wants the benefit of that track without having gone through the prerequisites to achieve it.
And I would agree with that analysis, Your Honor, if there was any fault on behalf of the plaintiff for not having gone through that process. But in this situation, where a municipality unilaterally passes a resolution stating that someone is non-civil service when they're truly civil service, that layperson employee is at a horrible disadvantage. What reasonable person is going to think that the human resource department, that the legal staff and everybody for this municipality violated that statute? It would never take place. And we say that she has pro forma passed whatever the civil service test was, because she functioned very capably in that position for a long period of time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Below.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Steve Below. I'm here on behalf of the defendants, appellees, the City of Loves Park, Illinois, its mayor, Daryl Lindberg, and its chief of police, Patrick Kerrigan.
And Mr. Below, I'm going to start you out with a question that is a little upsetting, I think. And I hope you can, you know, respond to it, because I see a very big problem here with your statement of facts. I could not find a single record site anywhere in your brief. And according to Ms. Kasna's reply brief, there are at least 38 factual assertions in your brief which do not appear anywhere in the record. And this seems to me to be a significant violation of Rule 28. And, you know, one that would normally cause the court to strike a brief. So, as I say, I'm really sorry to start you out with that question, but can you help me with it?
I believe that I can, Your Honor. Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 28 requires the parties to direct the court to the record. I would submit that the appellees have done that by citing their statement of facts to the LR 56.1 statements of the parties, document 28 in the record in full, as well as to the district court's opinion and its statement of facts, which is found in the appendix of the...
About incorporation by reference?
In essence, Your Honor, it begins, and it's a method that I've used before and apparently will never use again, but in a motion for summary judgment where the court's review is de novo, review of authority indicates to me that this court routinely relies on the LR 56.1 statements that have been filed by the parties.
That's in the district court.
Well, and on appeal, I, for example, have this court's opinion in, and I could find no authority directly on point. My proposition in Jones versus Union Pacific Railroad at 302 F 3rd 735 at 741, this court says we've consistently and even-handedly applied. Oh, wrong. Excuse me. It would be McDonald versus the Village of Winnetka would be a case where this court relied entirely on the LR 56.1 statements in reviewing the record, making its decision. Since the review is de novo, this court has repeatedly said we have to look at the record in its entirety. The purpose behind LR 56.1 in the district court and again on review is to summarize the facts by setting them out with citations directly to evidence of record that would be admissible at trial. And I would point out, and I looked at Mr. McGrail's supposed facts, 38 facts that he takes issue with. Ironically, none of them have citation to the record to show that they're disputed. And going back and looking at the LR 56.1 statement and the appellee's LR 56A31, I believe it is, statement, the final reply, those statements, every statement that we make in that statement of facts is supported by evidence that would be admissible at trial from the record, from the mayor's testimony, from Ms. Kasna's testimony. If you look, for example, at the defendant's reply to plaintiff's LR 56.1 statement of additional facts, Ms. Kasna states as fact in her paragraph 1, Kasna worked for the city of Loves Park for 7 years and never had a performance problem that resulted in any type of corrected action. We say it's undisputed that she worked for the city for 7 years, but say that it's disputed that Kasna was never subjected to corrective action and that it misstates the evidence. And the citation is to Kasna's own deposition at pages 25 through 27 and to Mayor Lindbergh's deposition at pages 12 through 13 and page 30.
Which is the point of having each statement cited to the record, rather than saying, well, the Court of Appeals is going to search through and find all these things that you would point out. If there is a dispute, you point that out and cite the record. That's what the purpose of that rule, as opposed to some incorporation of a block of things by reference.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that here that the record that is cited to is not only a block of not a block of things, but a very concise recitation of facts with pin citations throughout. And my intent, correctly or incorrectly, was to save this court time by referring to the documents
that
are the record.
Well, let me just say that for myself, I found it very difficult to verify the facts and, you know, did some digging to find things that I wanted to look at in the record, but it just is not the way we do things. We depend on you to supply us with missing information or to correct briefs. And I also want to note that it's true, as both the brief and Mr. McGrail noted, that if a party moving for summary judgment does not raise an issue in support of its motion for summary judgment, the non-moving party is not required to present evidence on that point. And the district court, any district court, should never rely on that particular ground in its decision. And here, since the city never presented the issue of the retaliation claim in its motion for summary judgment and didn't address it until the reply brief, it seems to me that the district court should have denied summary judgment on the retaliation ground. And, you know, maybe you can help me with that.
Well, Your Honor, I think that that's an error of record, because the retaliation claim was raised in the plaintiff's initial. It was one of the counts of the complaint, and it was addressed in the original memorandum of law in support of the motion for summary judgment. It was addressed more thoroughly, albeit in the reply.
Well, could you tell me where you presented the issue of the retaliation claim in your motion for summary judgment?
Well,
because
I
could very well, you know, have missed it.
Off the top of my head, Your Honor, my recollection would be that it was raised initially in the statement of facts in the memorandum of law in the first motion for summary judgment, and then was responded to in appellant's reply brief or response brief, and then addressed in the final reply brief. There were three ADA counts, two of which were in essence conceded in the response brief filed by the appellant, I would address that it's almost counterintuitive to me to say that it wasn't raised in the initial brief because it was responded to.
Well, the district court said it wasn't raised.
I realize that, but it was in fact raised.
Did you make legal argument that went to the retaliation claim?
It was raised in the statement of facts in the original brief.
What does that mean? You just mentioned that there is a retaliation claim.
In other words, when we were discussing the case in the statement of facts, we pointed out to the district court that there were six counts. We addressed what the counts were. One of them was a retaliation count under the ADA. Then in the legal arguments, we talked about the direct and indirect methods of proof and so forth. And my recollection is that the position we posited was that it was not protected expression because of the context of the discussion. And then it was addressed more thoroughly in the final reply because of the arguments made in the response brief.
So the argument that you've just referenced in summary was discussed in the opening brief on summary judgment?
I'm sure that it was mentioned. How extensively it was argued, I don't recall off the top of my head.
So the district court just got it wrong in that footnote?
I would suggest that it was raised, Your Honor.
Okay.
The other point I'd make, Your Honor, in response to these questions about the record and waiver of argument, is that at this level, the district court, as this court has said over and over again, could be affirmed on any basis in the record. And if an appellant, it's the appellant that waives arguments by not raising them, not the appellee. So the suggestion that we waive the due process argument, which is the argument at issue, I think, the Zelanka opinion and so forth, that's the argument that was suggested by appellant that we'd waive by not raising. At least that was my reading of the brief. And finally, as to the citation to the record, all of these disputed facts essentially go to Ms. Kasna asserting that her opinion of her performance is that it was good, and none of that is really material. None of these disputes are material disputes. None of them would be a basis for denying motion for summary judgment, because the fact questions raised by the plaintiff appellant here go to whether she was a poor employee. It doesn't bear on whether she had a federally protected property interest in her job or whether she was retaliated against.
What does the municipal code say about the job that the plaintiff held with the director of the Department of Public Works and Community Development?
There is no dispute. If you look at Section 10-1-17 of the Illinois Municipal Code, it essentially says that any elected official is exempt.
Right.
Any person who is elected by the corporate authority is exempt. And so, therefore, the two department heads she worked for were exempt.
Well, wait a minute. Forgive me, but she was a secretary to the Public Works Director and the Community Development Director, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Both of whom are appointed by the mayor and subject to confirmation by the city council.
Correct.
Now, what you've done here is you've described these officials as elected officials, elected by the city council, that is. Although the city council may have voted on these officials, this couldn't possibly mean, or I should say, this couldn't possibly be meant what is meant by an elected as opposed to appointed official. The Illinois statute, which exempts certain officials, clearly does not exempt secretaries of appointed as opposed to elected officials. And the language of the act is very clear at 65 Illinois CS 5/10-1-17. So as secretary to two appointed officials, she couldn't have been exempt from application of the Civil Service Act.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because what this act does is it says elected officials are exempt and appointed officials are exempt, and then it goes on to say that one administrative assistant to any elected official can be exempt, and then the courts of Illinois have said to us that means that an official who is exempt may have a subordinate official, and here they're using the word official to mean, the way I read it, someone employed by the city, but the one subordinate official may also be exempt. And it makes sense as a practical matter for purposes of the conduct of city business and efficient administration of city business that the exempt person should have one confidant, one assistant, whether the title is secretary or administrative assistant, I think exalts form over substance. The question is efficient administration of city government.
But how can a council resolution or even a long-standing practice of a city undo what is mandated by statute? You see, the language of the act, neither of the parties included it anywhere. And I'm not going to take the time to read, 65 ILSCS 5/10, but it's awfully clear, it seems to me. Officers who are elected by the people, it begins, or who are elected by the corporate authorities pursuant to the municipal charter or his appointment. I mean, it goes on and on and on. But I don't see how, as secretary to two appointed officials, these two were appointed, your argument can carry any water. Oh, dear.
Your Honor, I see my time is up. I'd answer the court's question if you would.
Yes, I'd appreciate it.
I would say, Your Honor, that the Illinois courts interpreting an Illinois statute have said that the purpose of the statute is to free the Illinois municipal government system from patronage. Its purpose is not to subvert the orderly administration of government. And there is absolutely no evidence of anything but good faith in this case. And the Illinois courts, no less than the Illinois Supreme Court, have said that an exempt official, and there is no dispute that these two department heads were both exempt officials, may have one subordinate official.
Those cases are cited in your brief?
Yes, those cases are cited in the brief, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And your time had also expired, so we'll take the case under advisement. Thanks very much. Just hang on a second. All right. Judge Roeder has asked that we give you 1 minute, so you can proceed with that.
I'll quickly address a few issues that came up. One is that you're correct, Your Honor. There was absolutely no legal argument. The footnote of the district court is correct. That retaliation issue was not raised in their brief. Secondly, the Zelanka issue that the district court unilaterally decided the due process claim on was also not raised in their brief. That caused tremendous prejudice because not raised in their brief meant it wasn't involved in the 56 statements. We didn't even know they were going to apply this Zelanka case until the decision. Had I had the opportunity, and this dovetails into your earlier question, had I had the opportunity, I could have shown that there is a haphazard, random use of the civil service testing and things at the city. For instance, when Kasdan was transferred to the police department, which everyone agrees is a non-exempt position, the act applies, she didn't take a test, and everybody that takes a test for civil service is supposed to take it before they start the job. So they do not, to answer your question about would she have passed the test. There's nothing in the record to say they would have even given her a test. Secondly, on page 13 of our initial brief, I do lay out the entire statute. And I think it's very clear, as I said earlier, that it's broken down into those two sections, and that there is not one shred of evidence in the record that there was an election by the corporate authorities pursuant to the corporate charter. It was an appointment and a confirmation, clearly of heads of a principal department under the first section. When the legislature took it out of the second section, they meant something by that. I thank you for the extra time.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.